H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 5. A Nightmare and a Cataclysm. 2. Willett freely admits that for a moment the memory of the old Curwen legends kept him from climbing down alone into that malodorous gulf. He could not help thinking of what Luke Finner had reported on that last monstrous night. Then duty asserted itself and he made the plunge, carrying a great valise for the removal of whatever papers might prove of supreme importance. Slowly, as befitted one of his years, he descended the ladder and reached the slimy steps below. This was ancient masonry, his torch told him, and upon the dripping walls he saw the unwholesome moss of centuries. Down, down, ran the steps, not spirally, but in three abrupt turns, and with such narrowness that two men could have passed only with difficulty. He had counted about 30 when a sound reached him very faintly, and after that he did not feel disposed to count any more. It was a godless sound, one of those low-keyed, insidious outrages of nature which are not meant to be. To call it a dull wail, a doom-dragged whine, or a hopeless howl of chorused anguish and stricken flesh without mind would be to miss its most quintessential loathsomeness and soul-sickening overtones. Was it for this that Ward had seemed to listen on that day he was removed? It was the most shocking thing that Willett had ever heard, and it continued from no determinate point as the doctor reached the bottom of the steps and cast his torchlight around on lofty corridor walls surmounted by cyclopean vaulting and pierced by numberless black archways. The hall in which he stood was perhaps 14 feet high to the middle of the vaulting and 10 or 12 feet broad. Its pavement was of large, chipped flagstones, and its walls and roof were of dressed masonry. Its length he could not imagine, for it stretched ahead indefinitely into the blackness. Of the archways, some had doors of the old six-paneled colonial type, whilst others had none. Overcoming the dread induced by the smell and the howling, Willett began to explore these archways one by one, finding beyond them rooms with groined stone ceilings, each of medium size and apparently of bizarre uses. Most of them had fireplaces, the upper courses of whose chimneys would have formed an interesting study in engineering. Never before or since had he seen such instruments or suggestions of instruments as here loomed up on every hand through the burying dust and cobwebs of a century and a half, in many cases evidently shattered as if by the ancient raiders. For many of the chambers seemed wholly untrodden by modern feet, and must have represented the earliest and most obsolete phases of Joseph Curwen's experimentation. Finally, there came a room of obvious modernity, or at least of recent occupancy. There were oil heaters, bookshelves and tables, chairs and cabinets, and a desk piled high with papers of varying antiquity and contemporaneousness. Candlesticks and oil lamps stood about in several places, and finding a match safe handy, Willett lighted such as were ready for use. In the fuller gleam, it appeared that this apartment was nothing less than the latest study or library of Charles Ward. Of the books, the doctor had seen many before, and a good part of the furniture had plainly come from the Prospect Street mansion. Here and there was a piece well known to Willett, and the sense of familiarity became so great that he half forgot the noisomeness and the wailing, both of which were plainer here than they had been at the foot of the steps. His first duty, as planned long ahead, was to find and seize any papers which might seem of vital importance, especially those portentous documents found by Charles so long ago behind the picture in Olney Court. As he searched, he perceived how stupendous a task the final unraveling would be, for file on file was stuffed with papers in curious hands and bearing curious designs, so that months or even years might be needed for a thorough deciphering and editing. Once he found large packets of letters with Prague and Rakus postmarks, and in writing clearly recognizable as Orne's and Hutchinson's, all of which he took with him as part of the bundle to be removed in his valise. At last, in a locked mahogany cabinet once gracing the Ward home, Willett found the batch of old Curwen papers, recognizing them from the reluctant glimpse Charles had granted him so many years ago. The youth had evidently kept them together very much as they had been when first he found them, since all the titles recalled by the workmen were present except the papers addressed to Orne and Hutchinson, and the cipher with its key. Willett placed the entire lot in his valise and continued his examination of the files. Since young Ward's immediate condition was the greatest matter at stake, the closest searching was done among the most obviously recent matter, and in this abundance of contemporary manuscript one very baffling oddity was noted. The oddity was the slight amount in Charles's normal writing, which indeed included nothing more recent than 2 months before. On the other hand, there were literally reams of symbols and formulae, historical notes and philosophical comment, in a crab penmanship absolutely identical with the ancient script of Joseph Curwen, though of undeniably modern dating. Plainly, a part of the latter-day program had been a sedulous imitation of the old wizard's writing, which Charles seemed to have carried to a marvelous state of perfection. Of any third hand which might have been Alan's, there was not a trace. If he had indeed come to be the leader, he must have forced young Ward to act as his amanuensis. In this new material, one mystic formula, or rather pair of formulae, recurred so often that Willett had it by heart before he had half finished his quest. It consisted of two parallel columns, the left-hand one surmounted by the archaic symbol called Dragon's Head and used in almanacs to indicate the ascending node, and the right-hand one headed by a corresponding sign of Dragon's Tail or descending node. The appearance of the whole was something like this, and almost unconsciously the doctor realized that the second half was no more than the first written syllabically backward with the exception of the final monosyllables and of the odd name Yog-Sothoth, which he had come to recognize under various spellings from other things he had seen in connection with this horrible matter. The formulae were as follows, exactly so, as Willett is abundantly able to testify, and the first one struck an odd note of uncomfortable latent memory in his brain, which he recognized later when reviewing the events of that horrible Good Friday of the previous year.
Yuai Nignaga, Yog-Sothoth, Hui, the Gib, Fuai Throdog, Ua, Ogthrod Ayuf, Gebla, Ia, Yog-Sothoth, Naga Nig, Aya, Zro.
So haunting were these formulae, and so frequently did he come upon them, that before the doctor knew it, he was repeating them under his breath. Eventually, however, he felt he had secured all the papers he could digest to advantage for the present, hence resolved to examine no more till he could bring the skeptical alienist en masse for an ampler and more systematic raid. He had still to find the hidden laboratory, so leaving his valise in the lighted room, he emerged again into the black, noisome corridor whose vaulting echoed ceaselessly with that dull and hideous whine. The next few rooms he tried were all abandoned, or filled with crumbling boxes and ominous-looking leaden coffins, but impressed him deeply with the magnitude of Joseph Curwen's original operations. He thought of the slaves and seamen who had disappeared, of the graves which had been violated in every part of the world, and of what that final raiding party must have seen, and then he decided it was better not to think any more. Once a great stone staircase mounted at his right, and he deduced that this must have reached to one of the Curwen outbuildings, perhaps the famous stone edifice with the high, slit-like windows, provided the steps he had descended had led from the steep-roofed farmhouse. Suddenly the walls seemed to fall away ahead, and the stench and the wailing grew stronger. Willett saw that he had come upon a vast, open space, so great that his torchlight would not carry across it, and as he advanced he encountered occasional stout pillars supporting the arches of the roof. After a time he reached a circle of pillars grouped like the monoliths of Stonehenge, with a large carved altar on a base of 3 steps in the center. And so curious were the carvings on that altar that he approached to study them with his electric light. But when he saw what they were, he shrank away shuddering, and did not stop to investigate the dark stains which discolored the upper surface and had spread down the sides in occasional thin lines. Instead, He found the distant wall and traced it as it swept round in a gigantic circle perforated by occasional black doorways and indented by a myriad of shallow cells with iron gratings and wrist and ankle bonds on chains fastened to the stone of the concave rear masonry. These cells were empty, but still the horrible odor and the dismal moaning continued, more insistent now than ever, and seemingly varied at times by a sort of slippery thumping.